Hi, this is John Hockenberry, and speaking to someone who clearly loves to listen at the time of their choosing, you should give the WNYC app a try, you know? Not only can you listen to this program, but it'll also automatically search for the kinds of stories and subjects you like. It's really cool, and it's free. There are other apps and radio stations available, but thanks for listening. Here's today's program. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. You know, everyone remembers the fall of Baghdad in 2003 after the massive U.S. invasion. Well, we may be on the verge of seeing a second fall of Baghdad, only this time to Islamist forces that are taking major Iraqi cities one by one, while the Iraqi military seems helpless. Mosul, Tikrit, Fallujah, on the march to Baghdad. Deputy White House Press Secretary Josh Earnest had a bit of a pep talk for the people of Iraq yesterday.
A lot of this aggression is targeting innocent Iraqi citizens. It's despicable. And we stand with the Iraqi people as they fight it.
And there was some upbeat spin from Stuart Jones, President Obama's appointee, to fill the position of U.S. ambassador to Iraq at his Senate confirmation hearing.
Although the news from Mosul is very bad, I think one positive aspect of this may be that the groups are indeed coming together to address this challenge. At least we're seeing signs of that in the last 24 hours.
Well, we probed very hard to find anything positive to say about the current developments in Iraq in a quite frankly alarming conversation with retired Lieutenant General James M. Dubik. America, he says, has to find the political will to return to Iraq in some capacity or watch everything the U.S. achieved there go to waste. General Dubik oversaw training of Iraqi security forces from 2007 to 2008. He is now a senior fellow at the Institute for the Study of War. Welcome, General.
John, thank you for the invitation.
You know, let me hit you with a really hard one right at the top here. You know, this looks a little bit like Saigon 1975. This roll-up is happening really fast. It's concerning me, considering all of the investment we made in Iraq. Convince me that I'm totally off base here.
No, I can't. This phase is happening quickly, but this is not the start of their counteroffensive. This started in 2011, and there was a series of campaigns that al-Qaeda in Iraq, then ISIS, the Islamic State in Syria and the Levant, have waged. And this was below anyone's radar screen here, even though we at the Institute for the Study of War have been writing about it pretty prolifically.
Does that mean that the strategists in the Pentagon and in the Obama administration were too narrow in their view? They were thinking purely within the borders of Iraq and not thinking regionally here?
Well, I don't know what their specific shortcomings may or may not have been, but it was clear, at least to me and to our analysts, that the efforts in Syria by the ISIS and the efforts in Iraq were joined. And they were joined together, acknowledged by al-Qaeda at the time. The effort is aimed at creating an Islamic State that includes most of northeastern Syria and much of north, central, and western Iraq. That state, if it's created, and right now the momentum is on ISIS's side, if that state is created, it is not in the interest of the United States. It's exactly the kind of sanctuary that we have been fighting to prevent since 9/11.
Now, I'm just looking at the map here. It seems to me as though U.S. passivity in Syria created a chaos and sanctuary opportunity for ISIS inside Syria so that they were easily able to resupply their troops from bases and sanctuaries inside Syria. So the instability in Syria actually has contributed to their ability to operate inside Iraq. Am I wrong there?
No, the instability in Syria is exactly a main contributing cause of the instability in Iraq. It's not the only cause, but it is a main contributing cause.
What would you say about the weakness or the apparent weakness and sectarian problems with the Iraqi government as it's currently constituted as a weakness in fighting back here?
Well, there's no doubt that the government of Iraq has made mistakes in terms of their domestic policies. that has caused disillusionment and other problems in major parts of the population, mostly Sunni. It's also no doubt that the government of Iraq's security policies have made the security forces more fragile than they were in 2008 and 9 and 10. But those things are long-term fixes. Right now, the issue is, number one, stop the ISIS offensive, and two, transition into a counteroffensive. Absent those two tasks being successful, any discussion about domestic policies in Baghdad or in Washington are moot.
For the Iraqis to actually do this, don't they have to unite Sunni, Kurd, and Shia and deliver some sort of united military front to ISIS? I don't see how that's possible.
Well, they're incapable of doing it by themselves right now. That's why, personally, I advocate the use of U.S. Air, manned and unmanned, the use of U.S. advisors to include ground controllers to make sure that those airstrikes are used in a precise way and targeted correctly, and the advisors to help the Iraqis with what they obviously cannot do, and that's conduct a proper large-scale defense and plan a large-scale counteroffensive.
Now, let's just stipulate that this is neither of our expertise, but my gut says Obama's not going there.
Well, I don't know whether he will or won't. Decisions change based on conditions. These conditions are dire, and these conditions are directly related to creating exactly the kind of sanctuary that the United States policy has been to prevent.
Let's talk Turkey and Iran for a moment. I mean, if the instability because of ISIS pushes the Kurds across the border into Turkey, that makes a completely different situation all of a sudden. And Turkey has asked for the UN Security Council to get involved here, partly, I think, because of the Kurdish instability in northern Iraq. And what's Iran's role here?
Well, if the ISIS is successful, the Islamic State of Syria and the Levant will border Turkey, Iran, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, and Lebanon. It will be a very destabilizing force for the region, for Israel, and it's a major threat to the United States because, again, it's a sanctuary from which we can expect planning for attacks on U.S. interests and U.S. Soil to occur.
If the U.S. were to stay completely out of this, who are the players in the region that might be expected to get involved, and would that be a good thing, or would that create a conflagration?
For me, the most likely place for the government of Iraq to turn, if we don't help them, is to Iran. And this would not be helpful to the region. It wouldn't be helpful to the United States. And in fact, it's not in the long-term interest of Iraq. And that's why Prime Minister Maliki, when he came last fall, asked for our help.
Isn't that the biggest irony of all, that Iraq would turn to Iran as a way of maintaining its territorial integrity after what happened in 2003 when the U.S. invaded?
John, I can't even begin to describe my emotions on that particular subject. What's clear to everyone is that the Iraqis cannot stop the ISIS offensive by themselves, and that the situation is dire, and that the two main tasks right now are stop the offensive and transition to a counteroffensive. We can help with that without redoing the surge. No one's talking about something like that. This is their task to do. They know it. They've asked for our help, and I think our help should come in three categories. Airstrikes, fixed wing, rotary wing, manned and unmanned. Air controllers to make sure these strikes are targeted precisely, and advisors to help the Iraqis plan and execute the large-scale operations that we know they don't have the capacity to do.
Retired Lieutenant General James M. Dubik oversaw training of Iraqi security forces from 2007 to 2008. He is now a senior fellow at the Institute for the Study of War. Thank you so much, I guess, for that very sobering conversation, General.
Well, John, thank you for the interview. It's no pleasure to give that kind of report, but it is accurate.
As the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan are ending for the United States, we have entered a difficult period of introspection and self-questioning, and the General's discussion really makes that clear. From the territorial setbacks in Iraq that pose the question of what has been accomplished in that country we invaded and occupied in 2003, to the tragic friendly fire incident that killed five U.S. soldiers in Afghanistan this week, or the prisoner swap that freed U.S. soldier Bo Bergdahl in exchange for five Afghan Taliban. These are moments that call into question what exactly we fought for or are fighting for, especially the debate over the Bergdahl exchange.
I think if the Taliban had been taking more prisoners on the scale that happened in Vietnam and World War II and Korea, this process would have been more, we'd be more accustomed to it. I mean, the thing is they've only gotten one prisoner, Bergdahl, so we just haven't confronted it till now. The Taliban commanders who were released from Guantanamo, my understanding is they were held as POWs, not as terrorists. We'd have to release them anyway. At least we got something for that. I mean, I think the analysis of that, frankly, reflects more the divisive politics back home here than it does the reality in Afghanistan.
That's Sebastian Junger, journalist and director of the award-winning documentary Restrepo. His latest documentary, Korangal, picks up where Restrepo left off, delving into the psychological journey soldiers experience during and after war. Based on his harrowing experiences in Afghanistan, if Bergdahl had deserted his unit, as some have charged, before he was captured by the Taliban, Sebastian Junger says it certainly violated a soldierly code, but it's not really a surprise.
I don't think it was a rational response, but I think it's an understandable one, maybe. And I don't know what he did or why. And I don't even know how much combat those guys were in. The guys I was with, the platoon I was with, they were in a huge amount of combat. And the idea of leaving the outpost was, just unthinkable because it was basically suicide. So what Bergdahl did is not a rational response to threat at all. Mm. It also is a massive violation, not of the military rules and orders. It is that too, obviously. But really, it's a massive violation of the trust of your platoon mates. They count on you. You're counting on them. And, even falling asleep on guard duty is absolutely unthinkable. Actually walking away from your post is an enormous betrayal.
And it is that bond of these small units in these very precarious places that is the experience of Afghanistan. Describe how that plays out in reality.
Yeah, that's the experience of war, period, from the walls of Troy on up through World War II, Vietnam, and now Afghanistan. War doesn't change that much for the foot soldier. And the only emotional and physical security that you have out there as a soldier is the fact that you're in a small group of men, 30, 40 men, who all of whom are willing to risk their lives to save you and vice versa, no matter how you feel about each other. That's what brotherhood is. Friendship, what you're willing to do depends on how you feel about the person. That's what happens back home. Brotherhood is absolutely unconditional. We're in the same platoon. I will do anything to save your life and vice versa. And it's a very, very secure place to be emotionally. And I think in some ways, as these guys come home and have trouble fitting in, what's happening is even though they're physically safer, they're emotionally more vulnerable because they're no longer in that group.
Junger and his collaborator and dear friend Tim Hetherington wanted to use documentary storytelling to tell the reality of war and to steer clear of the Hollywood special effects and myth-making that deliver box office numbers. Their lessons, embedding with the 173rd Airborne Brigade in the Korangal Valley in eastern Afghanistan, taught them that war is complicated and confusing and as simple as the brother beside you that your life depends on. Junger and Hetherington faced danger unflinchingly. Hetherington, though, died in Libya in an incident that has forever changed Sebastian Junger. The making of Korangal is an homage to Hetherington and a reminder that it is the profound simplicity of the soldiers, like Brendan O'Byrne here, who are at the center of it all and who carry the war with them for the rest of their lives.
And that's the terrible thing of war. You do terrible things. Then you have to live with them afterwards. But you'd do them the same way if you had to go back. So what do? It's an evil, evil, evil thing inside your body. And everyone tells you, you did an honorable thing. You did all right. You're all right. You did what you had to do. And I just hate that comment. Did what you had to do. Because I didn't have to do any of it.
This is the complicated thing about war. Brendan obviously is in a certain amount of moral anguish about civilians he might have killed or just the fact that they're out there shooting at people and getting shot at. But he also misses combat tremendously. He really misses it. And a lot of those guys missed it. And when they were when they finished their deployment, it was a very, very rough deployment. They saw more combat than probably any outpost in the entire country that year. When they got back to Vicenza, Italy, where they're based, a lot of them actually told me personally, you know, we would go back tomorrow if we could. Brendan was one of those guys.
And, you know, what that statement says is, yes, they sacrifice time. Yes, they sacrifice their sort of physical vulnerability. But it's even more than that. It's their entire identity is erased and replaced by this yearning for combat and sort of inner moral turmoil about almost everything that they've done.
Yeah, I mean, you know, some of them were more thoughtful and tormented than others.
Some guys were
totally fine with it, and some guys obviously completely freaked out. Brendan was a little bit in the middle. But I think somewhere the question lurks in all of them, did we do the right thing? I mean, the amazing thing about soldiers, and this must not be misused. It has to be used responsibly. But the amazing thing about soldiers is that they don't question what you tell them to do. And it's not their decision to fight or to go to war. It's the nation's decision, and they do exactly what they're told. And then they come back, and people are like, how could you do that? And like, what do you mean, how could we do that? You sent us. We just volunteered to do whatever you told us to do. It's your war. It's the nation's war, civilians' war. We just signed up to follow orders. That's really confusing to them.
One of the things in Karangal that's really remarkable is how the absence of combat sometimes encourages soldiers to do things to make stuff happen. And here's an example of that.
I'm sure Captain Kearney's probably not going to appreciate this one, but there were a lot of times when we went out into an environment where we knew was more exposing than necessary. Pretty much, hey, let's put the food on the table and see if anybody wants to come eat.
Wow.
This is Aaron Ear, and he was a sergeant in 2nd Platoon. A really nice guy. I know him quite well. But, you know, I got to say, like, when your life's at risk, all kinds of things feel outrageous and stupid, and even if from a larger perspective they're not and they're necessary. As Brendan said at one point, he said, look, if you're a platoon in combat, you're a gear in an engine, and all you know is that you're experiencing a huge amount of torque. You don't understand what the engine is doing, and the engine needs you there as the gear, but that doesn't mean you have any understanding of the role you're playing. And, you know, there's a little bit of that in Aaron's statement.
There's two genres of filmmaking at work in conflicts dating back really to, you know, Somalia. And if we were to stack up, you know, Black Hawk Down, Lone Survivor, you know, maybe something like Zero Dark 30, you know, movies that purport to tell the real story of things that we've experienced in the news, and then stack your films, Restrepo and Karangal. What is the message from the Hollywood story, and what is your message or your takeaway?
You know, I mean, I think those movies reflect the cultural myth about war as it's perpetuated by Hollywood movie making. I don't think it reflects the emotional reality of war almost at all.
I talked to a Special Forces guy actually a week ago about Hurt Locker, who actually was a bomb disposal guy.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, anything ring true? And he says, nothing except for the scene at the end where Jeremy Renner's in the supermarket.
Yeah.
And he can't figure out
right.
How many cereals there are.
I mean, you know, my memory of that movie, and I don't want to criticize another filmmaker, but, you know, my memory of that movie is that, you know, the lead character was this sort of cowboy guy that violated all the rules and took risks and all that. You know, and that's the ultimate betrayal of brotherhood, is that you do risky things that put others at risk. I mean, that guy wouldn't have made it a week acting like that.
I know how devastated you were by the loss of Tim. Did he want you to finish this film? Did you want to finish this film? What was your motivation?
You know, we didn't even get that far, really, of talking about this film. And we made Restrepo, and it was successful beyond our wildest dreams. And we went to the Oscars, and a few weeks later, he was dead in Libya in combat on an assignment that I was supposed to go on. And the last minute, I couldn't. And so I, you know, felt, among other things, extremely guilty about it. We had talked at one point about doing a three-part series for National Geographic, and they weren't interested, and then we sort of dropped the project. So this really was me being forced slash asked by a mutual friend, Nick Quested, who's the executive producer, to go back into that material. I really didn't want to, just for sort of emotional reasons. I just wanted to get clear of all this stuff. And he said, listen, go back into that, all that amazing footage you guys shot. There's another movie in there. And I went back, and he was absolutely right. There was another film that would do something very different than Restrepo did.
Are you done with Afghanistan?
I'm done with war, completely, utterly done with war. I spent 20 years covering war. I feel incredibly lucky to have had the career that I've had overseas. But after Tim got killed, all of a sudden, I just turned this corner. I mean, like within an hour, I was like, I'm done.
Well, we're glad you made it.
Thank you.
Sebastian Junger is a journalist and co-director of the award-winning documentary Restrepo. His latest documentary film is called Korangal. It's currently playing in selected theaters. You can also check out a trailer to the film by visiting our website at thetakeaway.org.
What's your take? Leave a comment at thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Goal!
Brazil, largest country in South America, and certainly the best place to watch the World Cup because it starts there today. But we can't all be in Brazil. But if we want a Brazilian flavor to go with our big screen TV, our sports pub, our living room, our outdoor projection party World Cup experience, hey, let us know where you will be watching the World Cup. Best place in your town, in your house, 877-8-MY-TAKE or thetakeaway.org. But then maybe we need a Brazilian soundtrack. Brazil is a musical paradise as well as a football powerhouse. And at the start of the games here on The Takeaway, John Schaefer, host of Soundcheck and New Sound, says he can help us. Brazilian music, I mean, that's huge. We could be talking about Jobim here or Vila Lobos if we want to go to the classical
music.
Yeah, I mean, this is a wide, wide spectrum.
Brazil is a Disneyland for music fans, as it is for soccer fans.
Yes, indeed.
So for those of us who are both, it's just like the cosmos has aligned.
Well, give us a sample. Give us a tour through some of the songs that we actually may be hearing accompanying this World Cup.
Well, let me start up in the Amazon.
Yeah.
Because there's a kind of a style there called Tecnobrega, which is rooted in the music of the slave trade and in some of the indigenous music of the Amazon basin. And it has been, as the techno part of the term would indicate, has been much updated and contemporized by musicians like Gabi Amarantos.
Saia vermelha, camisa preta, chegou pra abalar. Quando tu for na casa dela lhe buscar. Ela vai preparar café coado na calcinha, só pra lhe enfeitiçar. E se tu for aparelhagem, tu vai ver só, ela vai afrontar.
Techno, to be sure.
And, you know, I don't know whether you'll hear this, you know, in the stadiums as the games are played up north, but this is the kind of music that has become very popular. It is referred to as Amazonian pop music.
Is it dance music or is it?
Oh, it is. Yeah, it's
definitely.
All dance music.
Of course.
It's all dance music. You know, another part of the country that has a very specific kind of and a very distinct culture and music is the state of Pernambuco up in the northeast, where they have numerous styles of music. The city of Recife is one of the 12 host cities of the World Cup. And it is home to, among other things, a style of music known as maracatu, which has recently taken off here in New York.
Yep.
Foho, which we think of as an accordion-driven form, but which is even older than that.
You can hear that over on 45th Street.
Absolutely. Yeah. But there's also, again, a kind of contemporary roots-based music in this state of Pernambuco called mangue beat. And a good example of mangue beat is the guy, Chico Science, died at the age of like 29 or 30 in an automobile accident, but not before he kind of wrestled this northeastern Brazilian roots music into the late 20th century with his band called Nassau Zumbi.
What's the name of this tune?
The song is called Rios Ponches e Overdrives.
Love that. Yeah. That's fantastic.
Yeah, and although Chico Sainz is no longer with us, the band Nassau Zumbi still is, so they continue his work.
Any throwbacks to Brazil's proud soccer football history?
You know, there are, just as America has the great American songbook, there is a great Brazilian songbook. And some of those songs, going back even to the teens, almost 100 years ago, celebrate Brazilian soccer. There's a famous song called Uma Zero, which simply means 1-0, 1-0.
Oh, right, right, right.
It's the score, yes, by which Brazil beat Uruguay in their first ever South American championship in 1919. That song is still sung, but the one that everybody does not want to hear in this World Cup is the one that was written when Brazil won the World Cup in 1958. And every time they win it, you hear Brazilians singing this song. It's called A Taça do Mundo é Nossa, which means the World Cup is ours.
A Taça do Mundo é Nossa.
Now, you're not saying it's bad luck to play this.
I'm just saying if you are rooting for Spain or Germany or Argentina, you do not want to hear this song.
I see. So this song definitely rallies the troops if you're playing
it. It definitely does, and yeah, usually signifies something very good for the Brazilian team.
Never made the top 10 in Chile or Uruguay.
I would not think so.
So who are you rooting for?
I got to go with Germany. They're a fun young team, crippled by injury.
Herr Schaefer goes for Germany.
Well, look, you know, when I was a kid, you rooted. There was no American team to root for. You rooted for the team in front of your hyphen, the country in front of your hyphen.
It's okay for you to root for Germany. For heaven's sakes, who am I rooting for? You know, I'm rooting for the U.S. team, but that's going to be a very short line.
That's going to be a short route. Yeah,
it is. I think Portugal.
All right. Also in the group of death with Germany, yeah, Ghana, and the U.S.
Yeah. Well, good luck, and may the best World Cup win. And thanks for those musical suggestions,
John. Great to see you,
John Schaefer, host of Soundcheck and New Sounds on our partner station WNYC. You can find Soundcheck's Guide to Brazil, an ongoing series, at soundcheck.org. And we want to see what you look like here as the games begin. We want to see your soccer swag on you, okay? Send us a photo of your team colors, your jersey, your hat, your special ball, anything that shows your soccer pride. Use the hashtag MySoccerSwag on both Twitter and Instagram. Again, that's MySoccerSwag. Come on, folks. You know you're wearing the jersey right now.
One more.
You're listening to an exquisite pain that people stand in line to experience. It's a cross between some fantasy kingdom of sword-swinging heroes and villains and a boot camp for Navy SEALs. You're listening to an experience that is coming to define fitness and physical self-improvement. CrossFit. It's a kingdom of 20-pound wall balls, monster free weights, and people engaged in fiercely concentrated exercise routines. It's the opposite of the smoothie-sipping Stairmaster gym zombies watching The View on TV with their headphones while they exercise. The tribes of CrossFit drink in pain like nectar. They don't go to the gym. They call their workout rooms boxes. Their goal, extreme physical and mental fitness. In 2005, there were only 13 CrossFit boxes across the country. Today, there are more than 9,000. Out-of-the-box techie and veteran Tedster, J.C. Hertz, went into the CrossFit box world to write her book Learning to Breathe Fire, The Rise of CrossFit and the Primal Future of Fitness. We got JC together with two CrossFitters who run a box called CrossFit Unshackled in Rochester, Minnesota, in the shadow of the Mayo Clinic. JC Hertz, Chris, and Angie Munt spent some time sharing the CrossFit lingo with us of WADS, workout of the day, and AMRAPs, and the story of how JC had to experience what her iron-ripped husband was always talking about at the dinner table.
I am not a super athlete like my husband, but I found that it actually had an amazing sort of spiritual and mental benefit. The vibe of people getting together and throwing themselves into these intense gauntlets of functional fitness was just so different than anything I had ever experienced in a gym. And we got to the end, and the group of us really felt like, you know, we had speared a bison or something.
And on page 101 of your book, you say something that really is, an indication that CrossFit is the 180-degree opposite of, your Equinox gym culture. With a few barbells, medicine balls, pull-up bars, boxes, and kettlebells, and a nominal fee to CrossFit HQ, any certified CrossFit coach could become the proprietor of a CrossFit affiliate. It's a small business opportunity that is very low overhead, but very high impact in terms of the people that it attracts. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, absolutely. And if you go into the numbers, the Bureau of Labor Statistics has this explosion of tens of thousands of, personal trainers. And if you look at how many CrossFit trainers were certified during that same time period, about half of it is just CrossFit coaches, because it's this kind of DIY activity that people, particularly in the recession, could open up a business without being millionaires and needing that much capital to buy all of the treadmills and stuff.
So Chris Munt and Angie Munt out there in Rochester, Minnesota. When did you start your business, Chris?
We started in January of last year.
And it's going strong.
So far, so good. We're still afloat, so that's a good thing.
And Rochester, Minnesota is the home of the Mayo Clinic. So I'm wondering if the health ethos of CrossFit clashes with the Mayo Clinic types who come into your gym, or if it goes together.
It's a little bit half and half. There's some Mayo physicians that are all for CrossFit, and then there's other Mayo physicians that are completely against CrossFit based off of, reports of people getting injured or things that they've seen.
All right, so we've got a fantastic journalist, JC Hertz, and two coaches and small business people, Chris Munt and Angie Munt. I want you guys to just hose me down with the CrossFit lingo. JC, why don't you start?
So the main term is the workout of the day, the WOD. But I just wanted to note, to CrossFit Unshackled, this is a very tribal culture. So when people are searching for a name, it's almost like finding the right rock band name. And it's really about forming these tribes, because what you find is that workout of the day is, a tribal experience. And everyone who starts one of these CrossFit businesses, yes, they're running a gym, but they're also kind of a tribal leader. And all of the lingo, that's part of the tribal culture, the workout of the day, or as many reps as possible, which is an AMRAP, or every minute on the minute, which is EMOM. It's like, some kind of sci-fi thing. There's all its own terminology. But what it really is this kind of Paleolithic tribal dynamics going on in the context of fitness.
So I wouldn't say, what's your major, JC? I'd say, what's your WOD? What's your WOD?
Or what's your Fran time? Because, the dreaded workout of CrossFit is called Fran. And it generally reduces people to quivering misery. But then, this is the rite of passage, And so it gets kind of Games of Thronesy,
Oh, that's cool.
In terms of the level of epic experience that you're having in a CrossFit workout.
So JC's WOD, I believe, is Cindy, Chris.
Yes.
Is that high level or low level?
Oh, that's a pretty intense WOD. That's a 20 minute AMRAP. So that's pretty intense.
Angie, are you a fire breather?
Maybe slightly. Some days.
You got a Fran time?
I do have a Fran time, but we don't need to share it because there's probably a lot of people that know about CrossFit listening right now.
It's kind of like asking a woman about her age.
So what does it sound like when you're coaching, JC? Is someone like screaming at you the whole time, like some
no,
Marine
it's
boot
the
camp?
It's the opposite. One of the interesting things about CrossFit is that it's about building mental toughness. So it's expected that you will have the discipline to push yourself. And so mostly what you hear in a CrossFit gym is cheering. And I remember the first time this happened to me, It was on a strict press, you know, without using any legs, how much weight can you put on a barbell and push over your head? And I had it about 3/4 of the way up, and I heard from all around, get it, you got this. And my first thought was, wow, someone must be going for a personal record. And then I realized, wow, you know, these people they're cheering for me. And the barbell sort of levitated above my shoulders. It was amazing. It was like revelatory.
Chris, what's your sort of coaching sound? What's your mantra, whatever it is?
It depends on who I'm coaching. But if it's, the general class, it's, you know, very, very much the same. When we do our intros and we, you know, are getting people into CrossFit and kind of showing them what it is, we say that, you know, whether you're first or last, it doesn't matter. If somebody's still working out, you need to make sure you cheer them on and make them finish because they're part of the team. So we have kind of a rule that, you know, even if you're the first one finished and there's still somebody finishing 5 minutes later, you're still sitting there cheering them on before you put your weights away.
I like to say that it's like high school should have been but wasn't. So the person who just started will, you know, they'll be breathing hard, but then they'll just kind of recover. And meanwhile, you know, the guy who's, you know, the super fire breather is just shacked out on the floor, you know, gasping for air.
Well, there's certainly a kind of geeky empowerment story here in learning to breathe fire. But I'll tell you, the thing that's most profound to me about what you've achieved here, JC, is we talk so much about the divide between military culture and non-military culture in America. And in many ways, CrossFit is an intersection of these two worlds in a way that I've never seen before.
Oh, absolutely. And a lot of the early adopters of CrossFit were, you know, Navy SEALs. The Marines love CrossFit. It is that warrior culture. So it's not, you know, all kind of warm and soft and fuzzy. There's a certain fierceness to it. But there's a kind of a brotherhood and sisterhood that people who were in the Marines kind of recognize, and they love it and they miss it.
Well, J.C. Hertz, what's your plan today? Are you going to do a Cindy today?
Oh, I've already worked out today. I was doing back squats today. That was 6 a.m., baby.
Chris and Angie?
Today's a rest day for me.
I haven't done anything yet. I cleaned the gym floor, though.
Well, Chris Munt and Angie Munt, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having us. We appreciate it.
Chris and Angie run CrossFit Unshackled in Rochester, Minnesota. And J.C. Hertz is the author of Learning to Breathe Fire, The Rise of CrossFit and the Primal Future of Fitness. J.C., thanks so much.
Good to be here.
Tomorrow, a father with a lot on his plate this year.
I know that I'm still in high school trying to get a diploma this year. So I just want to be there for my daughter. I don't want her to be alone, cry alone. I want her to be with me. I want to be the greatest father, you know?
Marvin Ramos is 18 years old and sharing his journey as a new dad. Is your dad a model for you or the not dad? We often use our parents as a guide for what to avoid or as models for how to be a parent. Or what is it like to have no model as a dad? We want to hear from you. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.